Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin Mancini. I am also the co-host of the Podwork Angels The Rush Hour podcast, a podcast dedicated to the rock band Rush. I'm one of your hosts here, and I am joined, as always, by my other co-host. He is the podcast editor for thepotbreak.com, Alex Marcus. Hello, Alex.
Hey, Justin. Sorry, I'll be right back. It's just golden hour, and I got to get this shot before we get started.
Oh, I really hope you do. And I hope that even if you don't come back from that, I hope that at least the camera drops somewhere and we can find it. Our other co-host, unfortunately, is not joining us this week, Noah France. He, I believe, hopped on his TMZ-issued electric motorbike a day ago. We haven't heard from him since. I'm sure he'll turn up soon, though. So, in his stead, we have a special returning guest. He is the host of the Best Little Horror House in Philly podcast, as well as the We Heard About Pluto podcast, a psych rewatch podcast, George Heffler. Hey, George.
Hello, glad to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. I know it's been a little while. I believe we had you on to discuss The Invisible Man and I think also Paddington 2.
Oh, yeah, I'm all over the place, baby. Can't pin me down.
No. Well, that's a big reason why we like having you on the show. So
thrilled to be back and talking about Nope, especially because, you know, get back to my horror roots here after Paddington 2.
Yeah, well, you know, that film has its own share of horrors, so.
true. The justice system.
So, yeah, like you said, we are going to be talking about Nope, which, of course, is the latest film from Jordan Peele. Typically, this is a podcast where we discuss a recent movie release and then sometimes a larger topic related to that movie. And we might get into that a little bit with this film because there's a lot to discuss here. But before we do any of that, we're going to start with our full disclosure segment. This is where we discuss recent things we've been watching. It can be movies, it can be TV, it can be pretty much anything. So I wanted to start with our guest, George. What's been good for you recently?
So I've been watching something called Heavy Metal Parking Lot a lot recently, which is a short documentary. It's about 15 minutes where these two kids in Maryland were like, hey, let's record what it's like at the Judas Priest concert in the parking lot. And it's just such a like pure time capsule of everything that's going on at that time. You know, it's a bunch of kids like getting drunk and driving around in cars and stuff. But you can kind of see a lot of what's happening in the environment as well. Like there's a lot of, oh, I'm going into the Air Force in 2 weeks and wearing like Reagan era, like nuke them all and let God sort them out shirts and stuff. And it really is like pretty wild. I think there's a lot of funny stuff in it, but also like I showed it to my dad as well, who is a big Judas Priest fan. And he was like, you know, over the years, it kind of gets flattened out into, yeah, I've been to Priest concerts, but seeing this really brought it all back for him. And I mean, it's just remarkable. And it's such a in and out kind of thing. They're not wasting their time. It's a lot of fun. And yeah, 15 minutes. So how can you say no to that?
Yes, I'm actually quite familiar with this. I saw it pop up in your letterbox recently. I'm like, oh, wow. Like, yeah, I remember. And I kind of watched it on a whim back like several years ago now. I was living in a house with a bunch of other people who were into that kind of music. And I'm into that kind of music as well. And they're like, oh, have you seen Heavy Metal Parking Lot? And I'm like, no, what the hell is that? Like, what are you talking about? Like, oh, it's just like this short film where like someone like filmed like a Judas Priest concert. And I'm like, oh, OK, like, let's see what that is. And yeah, it's really cool to see the different personalities. I think as a big metalhead myself, I think I notice a lot of people, even people that I think would be pretty open minded about things about music, tend to pigeonhole, especially people who are metal fans. They think like, oh, they must like look a certain way, act a certain way. And I think what you see in that film is that it really is a diversity of different people who just happen to like the same music.
Yeah.
And I think also, to be honest, like I think it's a reflection of the music itself, which I think also gets pigeonholed. You know, it's always hilarious to me when people, you know, call like Judas Priest death metal, for example. I'm like, let me show you what real death metal sounds like. So as people know on this podcast, any excuse for me to talk about heavy metal, I will take. So I'm really happy that you brought this up.
Hell yeah. Unplanned.
Yeah.
There's also a bunch of other parking lot series videos that I thought were interesting. There's the Neil Diamond follow up, which is I thought really interesting because it's so the exact same environment, but with like older ladies and Neil Diamond. And like the same like enthusiasm and like when they're in heavy metal parking lot, there's like, we want to jump his bones. And then in Neil Diamond parking lot, there's old ladies who are like, we hear he's single now. It's like the same exact environment just applied to a different musical artist, I thought was so fascinating. And then there was also a Harry Potter parking lot where it was like the third book release. They went to like one of these book drops, and I was really expecting it to be like psychotic because I have like current Harry Potter stuck in my head, but it was actually very sweet. And I was like, J.K. Rowling, you do not deserve these sweet dorks as your fans. But it was very cute. And I just thought it was interesting that there was like a time capsule encapsulation of my dad, my mom, and myself done with these videos.
Yeah, that's cool. I had no idea there were other like, you know, sort of sequel or spiritual sequels to that. So that's pretty interesting. What about you, Alex? What's been good for you recently?
So I just watched a new film that just debuted on Hulu this week called Not Okay, directed and written by Quinn Shepherd, starring Zoe Deutsch as a girl who, or woman, I should say, who is kind of starved for attention. She's a photo editor at a sort of Jezebel-esque website, really wants to become a writer, really has nothing interesting to say, kind of wishes that she had a more interesting life. And in the process of trying to impress kind of the celebrity CEO of the website, played by Dylan O'Brien, in his like peak crappy dude self, really like major like Pete Davidson vibes coming off of Dylan O'Brien in this. She accidentally says that she's going to a writer's retreat in Paris just to impress him. This retreat doesn't exist, but she decides to commit to the lie and post a bunch of doctored photos on Instagram saying that she's in Paris. And then unfortunately, there is a terrorist attack in Paris right where she posted one of her photos just 5 minutes before the blast went off. So, and also she falls asleep and wakes up with her phone dead. And so all of a sudden it's like several hours later and her phone turns on finally, and she gets like a million messages. Everyone thinks that she is not reachable because she has been part of this bombing in Paris, and things really spiral out of control from there. That's the basic premise of this movie. And yeah, I really, really liked it. It's the film starts out with a warning, like even before the opening, like studio logos, where it says like warning, this film may feature like flashing lights. So like be prepared if you're photosensitive, and also an unlikable female protagonist, which I thought was a very funny little piece of satire around how Quinn Shepherd knows this woman is going to be received. But I love an unlikable female protagonist, so I've really enjoyed this movie. I really felt like it was a great kind of... I feel like movies today are just so starved for stories about now that are take place in the present that don't have to be filtered through past or nostalgia or like genre conventions. Like, okay, it's set now, but it's about a ghost, and that's a metaphor for life. Like, this is just a movie about something that you could 100% imagine happening in our world right now that wouldn't have been made in the same way if it took place 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And I really like that about this film. I think Zoe Deutsch does a really great job as this person who kind of just, you can empathize with why she would get sucked into this, living out this lie, but you never really, movie never lets her off the hook for it. And in large part, that's because of one of the characters that she meets along this journey of of Hucksterdom, played by Mia Isaac, who plays this young girl who Zoe Deutsch's character meets in a support group, who is a survivor of gun violence, a school shooting, and who has become a political activist. And she is just fantastic in this film. They really put her through the ringer and make her go to like really incredible emotional depths, and she's just so incandescent and such a fantastic find for this film, and I really look forward to seeing what she does next. But overall, it's a really fun movie. It really kind of says some things about society. Is it the sharpest satirical film ever made? No, but it's really enjoyable, and I feel like it has a lot to say about this current moment in a way that I feel like you don't get in movies anymore. And I was so relieved that this was not like a 8-part limited series, like, which you could so easily see it be turned into. I mean, obviously people who listen to this podcast know that I love movies, I love TV, but it's nice to just have a contained story in an hour and a half. And this movie did that so great and has a really great ending that I don't think you could have gotten away with if it was a TV show. So
what was the name of it again?
Very strongly recommend. It's called Not Okay.
Okay, that sounds wild. It was not the direction that I was anticipating it going based on the start of your description.
Yeah, it's really great. It's on Hulu now. It's part of the like 20th Century former Fox Searchlight group of films that have been pushed onto Hulu as part of their like effort to bump up the Hulu movie brand. And it's a little bit sad that it's not getting a wide release in some aspects, but I feel like a movie like this, oftentimes when they've tried to put in theaters in the past, kind of fades and no one even hears about it. It gets like a limited or semi-limited release, and then it doesn't ever get to that next platform on the release docket. So I think more people are honestly gonna find it being on Hulu, and I really strongly recommend it. I could see a lot of people, like, Hulu has a lot of like freeform TV shows get put on Hulu, and I could see that demographic kind of sucking into this one and really liking what this has to say. So I really hope that it does well for them, and it's a really fun movie.
Yeah, for some reason, until you started describing it, I was under the mistaken impression that it was like a horror movie. I don't know why I thought that.
Because nowadays, if you make a movie that is like takes place in the present time and is about something socially important, it has to be a horror movie. Otherwise, it won't get made. So I think it's a reasonable mistake.
Yeah. OK,
that's my job security, baby.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, we're here to talk about a Jordan Peele movie, right? I love socially informed horror films, but it's nice to not have to have a genre like twist on something just to get people's attention, that like you could just let the story exist on its own and have people respect it.
Yeah. And I got to say, like, I've been a big fan of Zoe Deutsch since Everybody Wants Some. I think that was where I first saw her. And I was a little disappointed with the last, I think it was, there's a movie she was in called Buffaloed, which I wasn't the biggest fan of, but I'm glad to hear there's another one I can
look forward to. Isn't she also a scammer in that movie?
Yes. She runs like a, I think she's like a debt consolidation service or something. I think that's what it is. Yeah, I haven't really thought about it since I saw it, to be honest, but...
And then on the Netflix, the Ryan Murphy Netflix show, The Politician, she also is on that as a bit of a scammer. She plays this like girl who is like in high school and is most known for having cancer. And then it turns out she doesn't actually have cancer. So I think that it's interesting to see that this actress keeps being gravitating towards this kind of role. But she does it really well. So I'm happy to see her here.
Little Evan Hansen-esque.
Yeah, the whole time I was watching this, I was like, this is the movie that Evan Hansen wishes that it could be, because no spoilers for the movie, but it doesn't turn out that everyone learns and grows and becomes a better person because the main character lied and horribly exploited the people in his life.
What a movie.
I'll never forgive that movie for being like, actually, no, it turns out it was a good thing that kid killed himself, because everyone's life is so much better now. Like, how do you make a major studio movie with that being the takeaway? Wild.
I feel like every step of that movie, somebody could have like taken a step back. Like, is this really what we're doing?
Yes. So if that movie left a bad taste in your mouth, Not Okay might be the solution.
Well, I got something, you know, a little bit different, but certainly, you know, it's interesting. You were talking before, Alex, about filtering stories that are relevant today through some kind of either genre or you know, historical period. And I guess I've got one of those, at least the latter. this is part of my continued quest to watch the rest of the 2021 films that I've been meaning to catch up with. And I watched this actually the same. I watched Nope yesterday, and then I watched this film when I got home later. And it was a really interesting sort of double feature, because this also is a sort of horror movie, but in a much subtler sense, I would say. The film I'm referring to is called Azur. This is a Swiss-French-Argentinian co-production. It's directed by a Swiss filmmaker named Andreas Fontana, and it takes place in Argentina in 1980. Now, if you're familiar at all with the history of Argentina, you know that this would be during the period of the Dirty War, which was a period of state-sponsored terrorism and crackdown from the late 70s to the early 80s. On dissidents, on people who were perceived as dissidents, and involved everything from interrogation to torture to execution. As a result, there were many, not just killings, but mass disappearances, many of which remain unresolved to this day. And amidst this political turmoil, we follow a Swiss banker whose name is Yvonne, who has come to Argentina because his partner, who does business there with wealthy Argentinian clients, has disappeared under mysterious circumstances. I'm sure there's a logical explanation for that. And as a result, he's kind of there to find out to some extent what happened to his partner. And there's a little bit of that. But he's also there to assuage his wealthy clients that everything's okay, everything's on the up and up, and maybe strike some other business deals as well. And the way this film plays out, it's kind of like a low-key thriller. You think it'll be this mystery that Yvonne has to solve. He'll be faced with this crisis of conscience as he recognizes what the Argentinian government is doing. And that's sort of true, but also not, because the film really doesn't give us any kind of catharsis once the mystery of the partner's disappearance is solved. There's no real action or suspense set pieces like you might see in like a John Grisham legal thriller or something like that. Most of the film consists of these intentionally vague conversations with wealthy clients and with people in the sort of upper echelons of the military junta that is running Argentina at the time. And so it kind of becomes this story about complicity in global injustice. And we gradually come to see that in a global market, violence and atrocity don't exist in this isolated space. They need funding. They need support. And some of that support and funding comes from other nations. And specifically, in this case, from this Swiss bank, which we learn is being tasked with a certain mission, which I won't get into because I don't want to get too heavy into the spoilers. But it becomes clear just the kind of role that they play in enabling the sort of horrors that the Argentinian government was perpetrating at the time. I also want to point out the name of the film, Azur, which is, I believe, is French for blue, but also is a kind of code word, as we learn in the film, for within the banking world, which means be quiet. And that becomes more and more relevant as the film goes along. And I just will say this is the kind of thriller that offers a little bit of clarity on the situation that goes along, but I would say more nausea is the reaction I had watching it as you learn more and more about it. And you just kind of become enmeshed in this world. It's really interesting to me how the wealthy clients that Yvonne is talking to and is trying to support, they're not necessarily supporters of the government, but they also recognize how they benefit from it. And they recognize that they're in danger if they make a big stink about it, because this was a time when the government was going after everybody, regardless of class. Obviously, it tended to be more the lower classes, but they did not discriminate when it came to people who were against them or had some possible beef with the government. So this is a very low-key horror movie, I would say, and it's definitely worth seeking out. I think the best thing I can say about it is that it constantly upended my expectations about what a thriller could be, and still remained horrifying throughout. So yeah, I would definitely recommend this movie if you're looking for that type of film. If you want to just be enmeshed in the horrors of the world and the things we may or may not be responsible for.
I can understand that impulse, since today, like, the world is just so, like, calm and calming and chill. So I could see why you'd want to, like, go to that escapist of, like, go to that time when things were less chill.
Sounds cool, though. I'm into it.
Yeah, it just, it's funny because, like, just seeing those two movies back to back, I'm like, wow, these are both very disturbing films in kind of different ways. But, but yeah, it was not the sort of break I was maybe hoping for. But yeah, it's certainly one I would definitely recommend. Anyway, let's move on, shall we, to our feature review. We are, of course, going to be talking about Nope, the third film from Jordan Peele. And I wanted to kind of just start by getting both of your general thoughts on the movie. And maybe if you want to share your general thoughts on Jordan Peele as a filmmaker, too, that would be great. George, if you want to start us off.
Sure. I think Jordan Peele is great. I thought he was funny on Mad TV. I thought he was funny on Key and Peele. And I think that he is both funny and incredibly talented at filmmaking. I have not only really enjoyed all of his movies that I've gone and seen, like just as entertainment, but Us and Get Out have both come up on my show. And they are so thematically rich and dense with meaning. And you can really dig into them in a way that is very satisfying for people who are into movies. I think that they also have important things to say, which is great. And I think that it's been pretty interesting to me to see how the message is kind of handled across these three different movies, because obviously Get Out is very textual. The message is very on the surface. And I think that Us is a little more nebulous. And then Nope kind of finds a tertiary middle ground in between the two where there is a lot going on. The message is, I think, pretty clear, but there's also a lot of the spectacle that he's talking about in the movie is also on screen. And I thought this one was really good. It's hard to say where it fits in my ranking just because I have gone so in depth on Us and Get Out, but I think that off the cuff, it is probably my least favorite of the three, but that bar is so incredibly high that, like, this is still in, like, my top 10 of the year for sure, without, like, even while I'm being like, yeah, it's maybe my least favorite of the three that he's made.
Yeah. And what about for you, Alex? How did you react to this film? What's your relationship with Jordan Peele as a filmmaker?
So, close personal friend of Jordan Peele here myself, but what I'll say about my relationship to his filmography is that I enjoyed a lot of Key and Peele when I was on Comedy Central. I thought that Keanu had moments that were good, but left me wanting a little bit. Absolutely loved Get Out. Get Out was my number two movie of 2017. Huge, huge fan of that film. I think it's such a special movie. It was second only to Call Me By Your Name, and everyone who listens to this podcast knows how deeply personal my connection is to that film. So definitely not an insult to be second to that movie. Us, I liked. I mean, we reviewed it for the podcast. You can hear my thoughts on it. I think it is a thornier sort of movie. I think he maybe kind of bites off a little bit more than he can chew with it, but it has some really great moments and some really great performances. And this movie, I loved. I thought it was really, really fun, really fantastic. I would agree it's probably third in the list of the three, but I had such a fun time. And the thing that most surprised me about this movie is that it just isn't what I expected it to be. And I think we'll get into that throughout this discussion. But yeah, the pleasant surprise of the third act just being entirely different from my anticipation was something that I always love to see. You know, when a movie can surprise you, it is always fun. And especially when it surprises you in ways that are surprising, which sounds redundant, but actually, you know, when you sign up for a movie like this, a horror movie, like, you're expecting a certain level of surprise, but you're expecting the surprise to go in a certain direction. And I feel like this one went in a very different direction that I really appreciated.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll get into that. I you know, going into this, I definitely was a big fan of his first two films. I thought that Us was maybe a messier film in a lot of ways, but still very interesting. Like, it was one of those things where it's like, I don't care if it's messy, like, it's still like, there's so much to unpack. And even something like Get Out, which I feel like has a bit more of an accessible appeal. It does give you this kind of catharsis at the end of it.
Accessible, like, Jordan Peele.
But even that, like, has, you know, they're like little, like, the details in that movie are so key. Like, there's a lot to unpack within them, even if you can enjoy it on like such a gut level. But there's all this deeper meaning behind everything. And I really appreciated that. And this one is, it feels very different from those first two. It's maybe, it feels maybe a little bit closer to us in my opinion, like just in terms of it's tackling a lot. It's not like any kind of, I don't know if there's like there's not a ton on the, like there's maybe a little bit on the surface, but a lot underneath the surface as well. And I just really appreciated the, like, I'll just say this, like, this film made me deeply uncomfortable. In a way that even like most modern day horror movies I find are like fun in the moment and then you're kind of done with them. And this one like really has sat with me. And that's even just like on a visceral level, like there are certain scenes in this movie that I found incredibly disturbing. But then on this larger level of like the ideas behind, like, why is that disturbing? Let's like, the more you think about it, they're like, well, that's a disturbing idea. It's not just a scene. It's not just shock value. It has some, there's much more to chew on. I just think it's rare, I find, to like actually find a horror movie that is horrifying, like that is actually terrifying. The scenes with the, let's call it an entity for now, that we see in this movie, I think are genuinely scary. And I like that there's a real craftsmanship on Peele's part in terms of what he's showing us and what he's not. And I think that, you know, I think also just such a likable cast. I mean, Kiki Palmer has, I think, really been the breakout star from this. And it's hard to see, it's hard to see why not, because she's like just such a breath of fresh air every time she's on screen. It's one of those performances where it's like everything she's doing just like feels completely right in the moment, like, and just like right for what the movie is doing. And so it's really easy for me why she's been a star. But I think a lot of the other performances are good as well. They're a little more, you know, they're a little more subtle. There's maybe not as much happening right in front of you, but still a lot. I think what Danny Kaluuya does with his eyes in this movie is pretty incredible. And
I also just think that his ability to communicate that he is in mourning without having it just take up the entire screen is really impressive.
It's very Western hero type of a performance, which I think is interesting. So yeah, I really enjoyed this. It's the kind of thing where I'd really like to see it again because there's so much to unpack. And I think seeing it a second time, I know friend of the show, Matt Taylor, has seen this twice. And the second time he basically declared it a masterpiece. So I'd like to see it again and just kind of knowing what happens in it, just kind of get a sense of maybe some of those deeper themes and what Peele's going for. But yeah, it's overall.
Matt Taylor, friend of the show, Matt Taylor, does like to throw around the M word quite often, though. I do agree that I think that this would definitely benefit from a second viewing because there's a lot going on. And also just to get to see the visual scale and spectacle of the film on the big screen another time, I think would be a very rewarding experience.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned that this has a little bit more of the sort of wide audience appeal. and I think that it's very intentional in terms of the sort of blockbuster stuff that he's pulling in. And obviously the release time of this, you know, middle of the summer. He has to kind of hit that. But I love that it is so appealing to general audiences while still being dense and having a lot going on. You know, so often people are like, oh, I just like to turn my brain off for these blockbusters. But this is huge. There is a lot of money on screen, it looks like. He has Universal behind him. I think that it just works really well to kind of fit in the middle, you know. With Get Out and Us, they're kind of like Kiki Palmer and Daniel Kaluuya, where like Get Out is this breakout and it's flashy and it has all these great stars in it that people weren't familiar with. And then Us is like the Daniel Kaluuya, where it's a little more like you have to kind of dig into it to sort of get more out of it. And then this is like their team, you know, this is like the two of them working together, finding a middle ground that creates a movie that people can come into and watch and go, oh wow, look at all these great images and stuff on screen, but then still have that underlying thematics to dig into. And I think that it's seeing seeing Jordan Peele like grow as a filmmaker is remarkable to me. And I think that this is definitely one that going back to, you know, and understanding sort of the way that it all shakes out and everything that he's maybe trying to say at the end, being able to apply that to the beginning and going back, watching it with a new perspective. I do think that this will improve from an already pretty high sticking point for me.
Yeah, and I wanted to maybe get into some of the things that we think the film is about. Obviously, spectacle is a big thing, but also exploitation. And I think it's really fascinating how the film begins, where we don't immediately have the backstory for it, which I think makes it even more disturbing. But we see this, as we learn later in the film, we have the aftermath of this animal attack on a sitcom show from the 90s, where one of the chimps playing a character named Gordy, who is the center of the show, has basically snapped and has severely mauled several members of the cast. How did you guys react to that? And how do you think that that sort of plays into the movie overall?
Let me first say that chimps are terrifying. Like, I remember a while ago there was like a story of some lady who like owned a chimp as a pet, and then it one day just went, no, I don't like this actually, and tore her face off. And ever since then, it has really kind of been like, I don't think that you should include chimps and stuff. That seems really, really dangerous. And this kind of plays into that. And I think that this opening does really work for me. I think that not only the sort of idea of taking something from its natural environment and then forcing it to do what you want it to do instead of its natural sort of life, but also, you know, the way that it does sort of correlate the way that we treat minority and child performers as animals and expect them to just do exactly what the audience says. You know, I don't think that it's any surprise that the term viewers gets thrown around so much in this movie. There's a that opening does really work for me. It is very unsettling. I think that pretty much all of the flashback scenes are the most scary stuff in the movie.
Yeah, I think that the flashbacks are definitely very effective in presenting this kind of horrific experience. I know they're very divisive in terms of, it seems like if you appreciate what they're going for, you're going to like this movie a lot more than if you don't really get what they're going for. But I agree with you, George. I think that the whole point that we're seeing this, and certainly my first way through, it's purposefully disorienting when you watch it the first time and then you slowly grow to understand what it is you're seeing and why. And I think it's a really important kind of examination of his central themes around kind of taming nature and the exploitation factor that is so present throughout the film. A lot of people seem to be of the opinion that, like, there's somewhat, if the message of the film is that we can't control nature, then why is it that the film ends on a happy ending where we've managed to control nature to at least some degree? But I feel like it's going for something a lot more complicated than something that can be minimized in that level of just like a single sentence. Like, I find the exploration here, especially the part of this that really sticks out to me so much, is that moment that after Gordy, played, we should say, by Terry Notary, who is my favorite Cole Obsidian from the Avengers films, and of course Kong from Kong Skull Island, that he plays Gordy in motion capture. And the moment that sticks out so much, and I think purposefully, I think that's what he's going for, is that after he has attacked several people on set, because we should say, no fault of his own, a balloon pops and it sets him off because he doesn't understand where it's coming from. And then people are being very threatening towards him, not realizing that they're being threatening because they don't understand chimps, because they haven't bothered to learn how to really navigate interactions with this other being. That once he is settled, he finds the younger version of our favorite cowboy hat performer, and he tries to do the fist bump that he's taught him, and it's like this moment of like, oh, he hasn't turned into this like monster that needs to be put down. He's still the same thing that he always was. It's just that these people who are trying to contain him haven't bothered to understand him at all. And when he shows that moment of vulnerability, of that accessibility, he gets destroyed for it, right? He gets killed by the people who are still not trying to understand him. And I feel like that is something that we see play out in the film with our alien creature as well. This sort of idea of like, we're afraid, we're trying to avoid that thing dominating us. Now we're going to try to exploit it for our own purposes. And when it finally shows us the beauty of and majesty of what it is as an entity, we're going to destroy it for that. And I think that there's something really interesting about that as sort of a running metaphor throughout, especially when so much of this film, as far as I'm concerned, is about this idea of like, how can we kind of capture our experience and have it be validated in our current society, which is capitalistic in nature. So the only way that our experience can be validated is by trying to exploit it for commercial means. And I think something for the, considering that, you know, Jordan Peele is a filmmaker, and this current era that we're living in, kind of capturing trauma in art as a way to kind of elevate the things that you produce, that is very in vogue right now. And this movie feels like a direct kind of celebration and rejection of that, right?
Yeah, I think that you raised a great point about how the message of this, I think it's very easy to be reductive about it, but it is, I think, a complicated movie in terms of like both pushing back on and celebrating a lot of movie making and, you know, the digital filmmaking versus analog and everything. And I think to your point about sort of nature in particular, Michael Wincott's character and the way that we see him as a nature photographer, I think does play into that. You know, you see him so frequently at the when we're first introduced to him, he's just like sitting at a table watching this footage of like animals killing each other. And like, I think that it's interesting that he's established as sort of doing this stuff from a respectful distance, that he is observing and he is celebrating this other culture, these animals, but that he also understands the danger of it and is trying to do it from a remove where he doesn't necessarily impact them in a negative way either.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately his sort of revelation and doom, I guess, I found quite funny, honestly. And I really hope they got that footage somewhere. But I wanted to go back to something that you said, Alex, because I do think it's and this maybe speaks to the nuance of the story and sort of some of the ideas that it's working through. But I like that when we see Gordy in that first scene, and it's almost like, certainly at that point, I assumed it was just the aftermath. I didn't know anyone was watching him. But I like that he's not still raging at that point. He's basically like settled down. He seems like he's kind of back to this sort of neutral state. Obviously, he's got, you know, his fists are drenched in blood, but at that point, he's just kind of like in this sort of weird, like, you know, he's not become a monster necessarily. And I think that's key to what the way that especially Daniel Kaluuya's character views this entity is that it's not an abstract danger. It's a concrete danger. There are things you can do. You can't necessarily tame it, but you can learn to deal with it in some way. And I think that's really important. That one scene with Lucky on the and the commercial shoot, I think, is also important, right? Like, he's there to make sure that, you know, he's there for safety, really. And while everybody's telling, I mean, I think it's pretty funny. Like, some people are saying, like, oh, like, tell the horse that we're ready. Like, it's like it has any, like, it cares about any of that, or has any conception of that. But I think that's part of what I find so interesting is just, it's not that necessarily that by the end that the Haywoods have tamed this creature, but that they found ways to deal with it and to, you know, will ultimately destroy it. But it comes like it's wisdom that's hard won. Like, they have to learn and observe and use their experience to try to figure that out.
Definitely. I mean, you see even in the way that Kiki Palmer, her immediate instinct is, how can I use this to leverage ourselves into fame? How can we sell this to Oprah? But Daniel Kaluuya's character is he says about the horses, he says about predators, he says it over and over. You have to go out and meet it. You have to sort of understand where it's coming from. You have to know what its like patterns and stuff are, that this is a living thing, and the immediate instinct to exploit it for your own gain is something that should be pushed back on.
But what I think is interesting about his character is that I feel like a different, probably a more straightforward version of this movie would have him be the kind of animal protectionist person, right? The person who is like, who like that Kiki Palmer is trying to exploit this, and he is pushing back saying, no, we shouldn't exploit this animal, we should respect it. But he's not saying that. He's saying the only way we can exploit it is by respecting it, which is very interesting when we think about where this movie ends up, where like ultimately it turns out to be impossible to exploit it without destroying it. And that is exactly the same arc that Gordy goes on too, where it's like no matter how you try to manage this creature of nature, as soon as you try to exploit it, you will end up walking down this road where you will destroy it in the end. And I think that if we are thinking about the larger themes and how it connects to this kind of this conversation about exploiting trauma for commercial gains, because we need to be validated in our society, I think it really says a lot about like what that does to a person, right? That it is when you put your pain on screen in order to have it be validated and respected, you are destroying a part of yourself that is beautiful as a result, because you are making it vulnerable in the most, you're taking the most beautiful aspect of who you are as a person, and you're making yourself, that piece of you, be so vulnerable in order to be validated and exploited, that you are kind of destroying it in a way, and hardening it, and losing a piece of your humanity. And I think that's what Nope is getting at more than anything else, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie is when they go to talk to Steve Yeun, and he like shows them his little room of memorabilia, and he's like, ordinarily I charge a fee for this, which that's telling but
yes.
Also the pain that is on his face when he's talking about like, oh yeah, Catan was playing Gordy and it was this great SNL skit, and the words that he's saying and his expression do not match at all. And you can see how he's like, if I don't sell tickets for people to come look at this memorabilia, someone else will. And so yeah, I might as well get something out of this trauma that I went through by putting it on display for people.
Well, and what's also, so I fully agree, and I think what is also interesting about that is that he is using this SNL sketch as his entryway into talking about his own experience, which was so traumatic. And I think that the kind of like the surface level read of that would just be, well, that experience was so difficult for him to live through that if he actually talked about the actual incident, that it would be too overwhelming for him. So instead, he is defaulting to this like literal parody of the event. But I think, and I do think that that's true, but I think underneath that is this kind of interesting observation about how we oftentimes will gravitate towards the kind of pop culture version of a story that impacted even our own lives. Like when we think about like the way in which we process trauma, a lot of the times we do it through art, we do it through this entertainment medium. And I think it is interesting to consider how good of an idea that is sometimes, you know, like what does that do to you? How does that kind of twist and turn and distort your own experience when you need to seek it out in pop culture as a way to process your events instead of actually truly doing the work of emotionally processing the trauma in and of itself?
Totally. I mean, over 1,500 people died on the Titanic, and most people know it as this romance story between Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. I think that that's a great point.
And like how many, like we have like hundreds, if not thousands, of movies about the experience of war, like World War II, all the way through current day wars, and like how people go towards those experiences. Like, think about how like American Sniper was such this huge box office phenomenon because all of these people felt seen by that experience, right? But is that a good thing? Is it good that the only way that we can process these things that we have suppressed inside of ourselves is to go and see it, the entertainment version of it, on the big screen, you know?
Well, I think that that's part of why movies like Come and See do find such an interesting place in our legacy, or, you know, in film legacy, because it is sort of transcending that. You know, it is, I think, don't get me wrong, I think there actually are funny moments in Come and See at the very beginning when he's, you know, still a child and still lighthearted, because that's the only way that you can sort of show the difference at the end. And that movie is so impactful, and I think that part of what makes it so impactful is that it's not trying to make it like a story of triumph or anything. You know, this is just bad stuff happening to everybody because of war. And I just think that, I mean, I'm not really like a war movies guy in general, mostly because of exactly what you're talking about, in that I find it pretty gross to celebrate this stuff. But you know, movies like Come and See in particular, I think, do such a great job of questioning that style of filmmaking, disaster movies, war movies, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's one I gotta, that's like been on my list for so long.
Oh, it's good. It's really, really good.
Yeah. And I wanted to, we were kind of talking about how we filter trauma through art. I think also, like, even through our own memories, I think it's really fascinating that one scene that we get later on, when we learn a little bit more about Steven Yeun, who plays, I think his character's name is Jupe, or at least that's his nickname, right?
Yeah.
He, like, after we see, we literally see from his point of view after the chimp has attacked everybody, coming up to him. And I think it's really, I don't think it's an accident that we're seeing from his perspective, and there's almost like this like tablecloth or something that's sort of covering like the sort of obscure, like almost like creating this translucent view of Gordy as he's approaching. And it's only as he comes up, he actually reaches his, you know, the chimp reaches its fist through, you know, and actually does come through this literal screen which has been put up. And I think I just wonder in that moment if Peele is maybe making us question, like, is this actually happening? Is this how Jupe remembers it happening? Like, he's really playing with that. And I think it's really, that's an interesting question, because so much of that is informing what Jupe does later on in the movie when he thinks he has this sort of this somehow has this relationship with this entity and this understanding of how it works. And I just think that's, I like that Peele plants that question about how the sort of hubris that this, the way that memory and that art can inform how we, you know, how we approach, other similar situations. And ultimately, you know, spelling the doom, not only for his family, but everybody in that crowd. And honestly, again, when I talked earlier about disturbing moments, like everything to do with that was like really made me deeply unsettled on so many levels, visceral, intellectual, emotional.
Yeah. The choice by Peele to go inside of the alien and follow those people as they're being basically digested, and how long that takes, and just the way you can, the thing that always gets me is like when after it eats something, right, you like it flies away and you can still hear the thing screaming inside of it for a while, and then suddenly it's silent. That is truly, I mean, I'll be thinking about that for a long time.
Yeah, it is great. I did think it was funny that before they sort of lean into the don't look into their eyes and that's how you signify aggression stuff, I thought that the like a little bit of tablecloth hanging down was like, oh, that's a funny way to like cover CGI.
Yeah, I think, what did you think of the CGI of this movie?
I think that it is pretty good. You know, I am a big practical fan. You know, I think that especially for horror movies, that the viscerality of having something actually there to react to definitely impacts not only the performances of the actors, but also you can tell. You can just tell when there's a thing there usually. But I think that this is good. I also think that he is talking about sort of the idea of practical versus digital, especially not only with the way that the camera works, but you can really see it in the moment where they trick it with the fake horse. And the idea of first of all, the entity is literally called viewers. Like Daniel Kaluuya says, I'm calling it the viewers. Like that's what they are. And so it's very easy to sort of interpret it as a stand in for the audience. And when the viewer spits out the fake horse, you know, it's saying like, oh, you should use like real stuff, or like we like it when there's real stuff. But opening that up to having these real creatures there means opening that door to exploitation and using them and possibly putting that creature in danger. And so it becomes a question of, is it worth it for the viewer to sacrifice these horses? Or is it, you know, just put a fake one out there and it's going to be angry about it? I think that there is a lot going on there about the conversation about CGI and where its place might be in filmmaking. And I think that it's handled pretty deftly here.
So, George, do you think that this is Peele kind of quietly endorsing using CG children from now on in all future films and TV shows?
Yes, I think that's exactly what he's saying.
Okay. I felt the same way, and it was weird that I haven't seen that as part of the discourse around this movie, so I'm glad we're on the same page.
I mean, you know, Daniel Kaluuya might accidentally punch you in the face, so, you know.
I definitely want to hear what you guys think about the CGI as well, but I do also just think that one thing that hasn't come up a ton when I've been seeing people talk about this movie is sort of the danger of legacy, you know. There is so much about how the death of their father has put them in a really bad spot where Keke Palmer doesn't want to work in this industry and they're having to sell horses to stay afloat and everything. And you can see how he talks about how we have to keep the farm and we have to keep the ranch and everything because that is our legacy. And the idea of using practical effects just because it is the way that it's been done or that sort of thing, I think it does all kind of tie together in terms of what the legacy of filmmaking in general might be.
Yeah, I think for me that goes back to that sort of idea that like we live in a capitalistic society, and so the only way that we are validated within that society is through our profitability, in a sense. Like, I don't think that this is like a Marxist film exactly, but I do think that this is touching on these sorts of ideas, and like the idea that the only way this family's legacy is the product that it is producing, right? It is this horse farm, it is the relationship with the Hollywood studios, and then if it loses that, right, if it loses that legacy, then it loses its place in society. They just become another set of people who have, you know, had experiences. They have a certain status because of this commercial investment that their family made all those years ago and have been able to maintain. And
it's something that they've had to fight for so long. You know, they, at the beginning of their safety pitch, they're like, you don't even know this guy. Like, the right. horse, the name of the film is like the horse or whatever it is. And so the black man, the black jockey on the horse gets completely erased by history. And so the idea of having to fight for your legacy, to fight to be taken seriously, especially as a person of color, I think is very front of mind for it.
Yeah, but I do think that there's a critique there, right? That family should be allowed to exist and move forward however is suited for them as people. They shouldn't need to be tied to this like toxic idea of maintaining a century old legacy of family just to maintain that status. They should have that status regardless, because they have worth and they're like these two characters. Like Daniel Kaluuya has such an interesting screen presence, right? But he has a very discrete set of skills that he's highly proficient in that should be respected respected on their own right, regardless of whether they have a commercial viability to it. And Keke Palmer is such a vibrant person with such personality and such kind of like, she's such like a force of nature, and she seems like she's so talented in so many ways. And that should be enough on its own. Like, it shouldn't need to be tied to this commercial like exploitation system, but because we live right. in a society where everything's worth is defined by profitability, then that is the dominating idea, to the point where these people choose to not run for their lives from this monster that is killing everything. They say, no, we, in order for this experience to matter, we need to be able to have a picture of it that we can sell, or else yeah. it won't matter. And I think that that's all kind of a piece. And it's very interesting. You don't, it's very interesting to embed that critique into a big budget blockbuster film that's coming out in the summertime, you know?
So early on in the movie too, you know, like, you see so quickly that there's sort of, he's the steak, she's the sizzle. And it's only by putting the two together that it's able to sort of coalesce into something that is viable for the industry, for it to be mm-hmm. commoditized. And I think that it is fascinating to set that up so early for you to constantly be thinking about it, especially when later the TMZ guy comes, the faceless monolith of TMZ, another yeah. just audience. He's also a white guy, to come in and try and scoop them and get this image and say, well, if you're not going to do it, then I'm going to do it. Same thing with Steve Yeun and SNL. It really is just all set up so early and then constantly reinforced throughout the movie.
Yeah, yeah. I love the production design of the TMZ person. I love yes. I like that helmet is so, he's like the T-1000 just like running through this yeah. movie trying to mess everything up. It's so great. And I love that, like, it has that like little circle, so it does look like a giant eyeball basically, which is all it is. It's just like this artifice of external looking onto the event in a way that is so kind of voyeuristic and intrusive. And it's a really great little thing that says so much, and this movie is filled with those things.
Yeah, and getting to what you were saying, George, just what you were saying about legacy, George, I thought was interesting, because it's very clear that that Otis Jr., Danny Kaluuya's character, and Emerald, Keke Palmer's character, had very different relationships with their father, played by Keith David. And I feel like, you know, I always, like, Keith David's one of those actors that's just, like, naturally likable to me. So to kind of see that both these people probably saw him very differently was really fascinating. And we don't learn a ton about like what it was like growing up with him, but there's little things like the story that Emerald tells about how she was promised this horse, and then she just saw the two of them out there, and it was clear she was not getting the horse, and her father didn't acknowledge her, but her brother did. You know, I just think it's interesting that, like, it makes a lot more sense when you learn that she's kind of had to go off on her own and find her own path, which Otis Jr. does not approve of, even saying, like, that's your side. She's like, that's like my main hustle. Like,
yeah.
But in his mind, it's a side hustle because it's not the ranch. It's not the family. And I just,
his name is even Otis Jr. Like, it's literally yeah. been placed on him by his father that you have to, like, be me, basically.
Right. Just like that, her skills, which we like, she kind of rattles them off toward the beginning of the movie, those become essential for getting to capture the creature and ultimately yeah. defeat it later right. on, which have nothing to do with the ranch. So I just think that's a really interesting
great point. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I do like the detail of them choosing to call the entity, right, Jean Jacket, which is the horse that that represents this fissure between their relationships, their separate relationships with their father, right? It was this horse that was promised to Keke Palmer's character, was promised to be the first one that she got to learn the family trade to, and instead she was denied that, and Daniel Kaluuya was given that that chance to do that as well, and that is like a clear kind of trauma that Keke Palmer's character has endured, this moment of separating from the family in a way that has informed the whole rest of her life. And the idea that they can then use this animal, this alien presence, as the thing to reunify the family unit is very interesting. But it's what I think is so interesting about this movie. And I will say, like, the more that we talk about it, the more I like it, is the idea that, like, this is both, like, this movie is both guilty of the thing that it is also criticizing art for doing, right? It's a great exploration of trauma and the difficulty of exploitation, while also critiquing the idea that we even should be doing this in film. And I think that that's it's a hard line to walk, and I think it does it much better than something like Us, which has similar kind of ideas of like really kind of high-minded metaphors for society that doesn't always land and kind of sometimes distracts from the story that you're trying to tell, or at least raises questions that can distract. And I think this movie is so efficient of both being the thing that it wants to be and also being critical of that thing at the same time while delivering on the chills and the thrills of a fun movie.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that in order to be a good satire, you also have to be a good example of the thing you're satirizing. And, you know, you can see it in Starship Troopers, I think, is probably the best example of, like, that is a very fun fascist movie. And then once you look at it a little longer, you see, oh, this is clearly criticizing all of these things. But you are also able to look at it in both ways. You can sort of turn your brain off or whatever and watch Starship Troopers, and yeah, it's a fun sci-fi movie full of good-looking people shooting up bugs, and it's fun in that way. But then there's also so much going on that it kind of lures you into it. It like tricks you into understanding the actual message of it, and I think that Nope does a great job with that as well. It is a summer blockbuster. It reminds me of Jaws and Tremors and stuff like that. But also it is clearly so sharply critical of them that it's an interesting conversation to both be and criticize the thing.
And certainly there's a self-awareness that is very clear throughout. It's not absolving itself, but
yeah,
it's
definitely
aware that it's happening. Yeah.
I am curious. I did want to mention this just because I also really enjoyed Crimes of the Future. I don't know if you guys watched that one.
Not yet.
Yeah, I wanted to, but it was in and out of theaters so fast.
Yeah,
so it's gonna probably be an early 2023 watch for me.
Well, let me just say that in my opinion, 2022 is the year of movies from auteur filmmakers ruminating on what it means to make movies and get chewed up by an audience and then spit out. And I think that this and Crimes of the Future are so fascinating in terms of being a great example of that filmmaker's work, but then also being like, what am I doing here? Like, am I even the Cronenberg one in particular is very interesting in terms of his legacy of like body horror and the things that he's influenced, and maybe people losing track of how he did have messages in a lot of his movies and stuff. And it becomes kind of just a shock value thing. And I think that this sort of ties into that in terms of like, he is clearly interested in making these films and celebrating movie making, but there's also this focus on the people below the line. You know, it's animal handlers and basically a gaffer and a cinematographer are our three groups that work together here. And it is both a classic example and also subverts it in a lot of interesting ways. I know that that's basically what I just said about the satire stuff, but the actual subversions as they manifest in the movie, I think are all fantastic, even not looking at it from a 1,000-foot view.
Yeah, I fully agree. And I think we've been spending so much time talking about the ideas of this movie because there's so many and they're so interesting to discuss. But I would be remiss not to mention some of the actual things in the movie that I really loved. And one of those is definitely the Brandon Pereira character, Angel Torres, who is kind of like the Fry's electronics guy who the Kiki Palmer and Daniel Kaluuya meet to when they're trying to get installing cameras. I think he is such a fun presence in this movie. It would be so easy for that that character type can oftentimes be kind of grating. The kind of guy who's always like, this is bad, don't do this. You know, like, you're kind of, it could get really annoying. And I think, or it could, there could be like a forced kind of like sentimentality that a character like that brings, because presumably he's getting set up to be killed at some point later in the movie, right? So you have to learn that he has like a sister with like cancer or something like that. But in this movie, he just gets to be this really fun, irreverent presence, and somebody, and like injects like a lower stakes humanity to the proceedings that I found very relatable. And also, he's ridiculously hot in this movie, and I think that needs to be stated on record.
I thought it was so funny, the like the first time that they meet him and they walk up and he's like, do you want the installation? And they're like, no. And he's like, okay, no installation, whatever you say. Like, he really captures being like an asshole Best Buy employee.
But yes, as does Barbie Ferreira, who is his co-star in the Fry scenes. I was a little sad that she didn't get to come to the ranch. I feel like she could have been fun there too.
Yeah,
and I was curious how you guys felt about that, because we hadn't talked a lot about some of the supporting characters, but I thought he was really fun as well. Certainly, I got to say, as someone who lived in California for 4 years, certainly hotter than any Fry's employee I ever saw when I was there. But yeah, and I like that, like, we learn a little bit about his backstory. Like, there, I mean, it's not like a lot, but you know, the fact that he's going through a breakup, and I'm like, yeah, I could totally see that. Like, you've gone through this really, you know, traumatic thing in your life, and you're kind of looking like, hey, this is like a nice diversion. Like, and you know, he's kind of, I like that he offers a little bit of, you know, maybe like context, just in terms of like pop culture when it comes to aliens. Like, he's offering a lot of that, which I think is pretty fun. And I think also just making us aware of like what the perceptions are, and then the film challenging that as we learn more and more about Jean Jacket and what it actually is.
I also want to give a shout out to Ren Schmidt, who plays Amber Park, who's Steven Yeun's wife in this movie. I love her as an actress. She's one of the leads of For All Mankind, Apple TV Plus's NASA space race series. And number one, it was fun to get to see her play her own age, because on that show, they have an accelerated timeline. So every season is about 10 years. And so this woman who is like 30 is playing like a 55-year-old now on television. So it was nice to see her be her own age. But also, I just thought it was really interesting the way that like her and Steven Yeun together play this couple, and they get so little screen time, and yet they really feel like they have a full life together and a really intimate connection. And there's like a sense of tragedy when they've been killed by this sort of like in group endeavor, the ambition that they've born. And I just think, and almost all of it is done completely silently and just physicality between the actors, and that's the sort of detail that this movie doesn't need, but it is amplified by, because it makes us care about those people just a little bit more. And without having the kind of big long monologue of, I remember when I met you when you were 19 and you and I helped you turn your life around. Like, it would be so easy to make that into a cliche, but they just trust the actors to just do it with their physicality and with a look here and a look there. And I'm just always a sucker for when actors can make you feel like they've lived a whole life together when you see them on screen for 10 to 15 seconds. So yeah. I always want to call that out.
Yeah, they did a great job. I will say, we have been very complimentary towards this movie so far. I think as much as I like the idea of Michael Wincott's character, I don't know that I loved his performance in this. I think especially like when he is doing the like Flying Purple People Eater song, I was like, this is veering into parody here. Like, it's also like, I think that like he probably could have got away with just saying a couple lines from the song instead of doing the whole verse. So that exact portrayal, I think I liked the idea of more than the actual portrayal. But I do think that everything that's going on with Jupiter's Landing is just incredible. The cockiness of thinking that he can control this thing, the idea that like he's now, even though he went through this manipulation and commoditization, now he's saying, well, you know, you got to do what you got to do to make it in the biz. And so now he's putting the horses out there to get sacrificed to this alien. I just think that everything that's going on there is so fantastic. I did also, before I forget, want to ask you what you guys think is up with the shoe at the flashbacks.
The thing that I find interesting about it is I feel like it's maybe more for Jupe than it is for anyone else, because he's the only one who has he has the memory of that, certainly. We don't actually know whether it's true or not. But then, like, the way he, like, just by framing it, like, there's nothing super special about that. It's only special in his memory that occurred. So I just thought that was, again, I think Peele is maybe playing with subjectivity and about the level of importance that we attach to our memories and how that informs how we, you know, how we continue to interact with the world.
Cool.
Yeah. And I think it's also just like that kind of Jordan Peele, like fetishization of an image, right? Like there's such an evocative quality to of a shoe, like a lone shoe in the aftermath of a traumatic act of violence, because it just says so much, right? Like obviously that shoe was on a person. The fact that shoe was no longer on a person indicates a lot of things must have happened that we don't see. Instead, we just see the aftermath in that one shoe and like what is missing, and like the absence is so informative of what the emotional like experience of that moment must be. So I feel like that's sort of like that idea of like he had an idea, had an image in his head, and he wanted to just like build a whole kind of idea around it. Like he's talked about that on other projects with other things in the past, and I feel like that might be the case there. Because I know I found it being very evocative, the idea of like just that lone shoe on that set. Because like, you know, the amount of violence that like either it's like someone is fleeing for their life and their shoe falls off because of this act of panic, or that like they've experienced such a level of brutal violence that their clothing is being pulled off of their body. Yeah. Either way, it's very emotional. And like the point of a shoe is to be filled with a foot, right? Which is, it seems kind of silly to say, but it is. So like the fact that there is a shoe there without the foot is like it is this kind of, it's this visualization of absence of personhood that is really, that could speak towards, you know, the impact of brutal violence.
Yeah, I think that's a great trauma point. Especially because it is still like up on its toe, it is like kind of in a weird position. So I think that the sort of emphasis on absence is a really great point. And speaking of absence, I also did watch the trailer for the first time before this conversation. And there is a lot of footage in that trailer that's not in the movie. And so I'm like, where's all this footage? I'm excited for the deleted scenes, I guess, in the Nope Blu-ray. But yeah, there was a bunch of stuff in the trailer that wasn't in the movie. So
interesting. Anything in particular that like that piques your interest that didn't make the cut?
There was a scene of somebody like in the aftermath while everyone is fleeing the Gordy scene. There's somebody walking towards the like the set. And I'm like, what the heck is going on here? So that looked interesting. There was also, I think, just some more conversations between the siblings. So the Haywoods. So, you know, that's cool. You know, I wouldn't be mad about getting a little more brother sister time.
One thing that I'm curious about so one of the things that I alluded to earlier in a review that I really enjoyed was this kind of surprise of what the movie became. And now that we're kind of like in the thick of it more, I wanted to return to that because I obviously, you know, it's a movie about, we know that it's about aliens in some way. We think that it's going to be about this like flying saucer with that aliens are going to invade. We find out that it's actually the alien is the flying saucer, which I think is just a clever idea. But then like, I really thought the movie that we were getting was the movie as it existed for the first hour, basically, where it's like they experience the alien, they have to run for their life from the alien attacks the house, then they survive, right? And then it's like movie over, right? No, then it becomes kind of like this fun, almost heist movie for the second half. And I think I've seen a lot of people being like, I don't get that. Like, it seems like the movie falls apart when it becomes that. It kind of becomes silly and ridiculous and it's not scary anymore. And I just like, I'm not as big of a horror movie fan as George, for instance, so that might be coloring my opinion a little bit, but I found it to be such a fun kind of relief of like, oh, we're actually getting a whole different thing, and there's such a exciting energy to it of trying to see the plan come together, and Peele does such a great job of giving us just enough to be able to follow what's happening while leaving some surprises for us to see as it gets exploited. And then of course, like with every good heist, like there's a wrinkle that gets thrown in unexpectedly with the TMZ guy, and it like causes everything. So I just loved all of that, and it's like a secret heist movie is always going to have just a really fun experience for me. But I'm curious how it worked for you guys.
So one thing I think is key is that most of the first part of the movie, when the when this alien appears, it's at night. The scene where that you're mentioning with the sort of secret heist, like, it's all during the day. So it seems very purposeful that maybe there is a level of we're supposed to be more aware of this alien, what it is. And I think that's key to what he's doing with the alien, which is turning it from this abstract threat into a concrete threat. It's a thing that you can see. It also reveals itself in that last scene. And it's, I think it's part of what, like, this reckoning with what this thing is that it's an animal, and that it's not this higher intelligence. Like, it's not this, like, ultimate thing that's going to destroy us or be our friend or something. It's an animal. It has to eat. That's what it is. It poses real danger. And I don't think it needs to be as horrifying in those moments as it is in the earlier scenes as a result, because it's something that they've learned to deal with and that they learn to, you know, to combat and to ultimately exploit and destroy. So I guess I saw it that way. And at the same time, there's still moments in that scene that are pretty terrifying. The whole, like, opening up of the, I guess, of the mouth or whatever that is, like, that was, like, I didn't know what I was watching. I didn't know if I was watching a machine or an organic entity. I've heard that it was inspired by, like, different sea creatures and stuff like that. But that was just, like, I had no understanding of what that was, and it was still horrifying. So even in those moments where they think they figured it out, there's still some things they need to figure out. And it still did have those moments of just, like, of, again, I would say, of horror, you know, that maybe the first part of the film had in maybe a different way.
I also think that it is just kind of leaning into that Jaws analogy again. It, you know, we have Michael Quintcott our two main characters there as Brody and Hooper. And they get to go out and hunt down Bruce the shark or Jean Jacket the alien. And I think that by sort of turning it on its head, you get to sort of be like, oh, humanity is the real monster. Like, we're the ones who are now hunting it down. And it is, you know, again, with Jaws, they talk about the territoriality of the shark and how the only reason that it's attacking these people is because, oh, now we have we're going into the water where it's made its home. And so it says, well, I have to defend my property. And so there is sort of this idea of the two having laid claim to this area in much in the way that Jaws did. And now it becomes a more straightforward fight as opposed to just the terror of running away and trying to figure out what it is. I think Justin made a great point about the concreteness of it now that they have a little more understanding between all of their components of the group. Now being able to contribute more information, you know, I think that Angel in particular is able to contribute a lot of, like, well, here's what aliens do to it that is helpful. And at some point they have to make a stand. And I think playing into that sort of fight or flight aspect of animal nature, where it's like, well, you can run away from it or you can stand and fight. And that's what they choose to do. And I think that it does work. Not only in terms of, I think it still does maintain some of those horror moments. It does play into the Jaws horror homage, but also does work really well with just sort of the analysis and examination of how we interact with animals and stuff like that for its exploitation and the way that they react to us intruding on their homes.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's funny, this movie, when I watched this movie in theaters, there was the trailer for the Idris Elba movie Beast ahead of it, which is this movie that's coming later in the summer, which if you listen to our summer preview episode, we did talk about it, that it was on its way, where it's basically just Idris Elba is attacked by a giant lion. And I just feel like once you watch this movie, it's like, what is the point of making a movie like that? Like, this movie is just like, it basically... It's like, what, like, it's just such a great kind of, like, there's, it's that exact idea of that sort of movie with so much more added to it. It's like watching that is would just be such like a waste of time after this.
Yeah, it is funny how similar to that, I think, you know, you get these movies like Razorback or Grizzly or Orca, where it's all of these sort of spin-offs of Jaws, where if they kind of lose a little bit of what made Jaws special, in that the humanity of it is the interesting part of Jaws. You know, it's great that there is a scary shark in the water, but we spend so much more time with Hooper and Quint and Brody that that's really what we're there for. And so I think of those three that I named, I like Orca the best because there is a little more going on. But those animal attack movies do kind of strip out the interesting elements of the thing that they're imitating. And I think a similar way that this movie is commenting on. And so it is interesting that that movie was a trailer for mine as well. And to see it and be like, yeah, looking back at it and being like, well, this is literally talking about that kind of movie.
Yeah.
Although that has a CGI lion. So, you know, it sort of is sidestepping the exploitation aspect of it, which honestly, the movies that I mentioned have already been made. So whether I say I like them or don't, and I think that it's interesting that they used these animals, it's already done. The damage is done. So I do like the exploitation aspect of watching those kind of movies. I understand that it's not great for the animals, but I like a lot of horror exploitation movies in general, and sort of you're coming there, the exploitation aspect. A lot of people misinterpret exploitation movies as like, oh, you are, it's about exploiting the thing, but it's really about exploiting the audience and what they're there to see. And so for me, these animal exploitation movies are there because I want to see the animal. I want to see humans in danger because this animal is scary and coming after them. And so it does kind of neuter the movie in a way, pun kind of intended, that I don't think is to its benefit. And so a movie like this, where it is more of a commentary about it, has more going on than the exploitation version of it, especially when that is now not even having the exploitation component.
It's true. But I mean, how else can you get a lion to act like a rogue lion, which is how that movie is described?
So true. So true. Yeah.
I'm like, what? So it's like, honestly, it made me think of not a movie I really care to think about very often, but like Jurassic World with the, you know, Indominus Rex, like it's killing for sport. I'm like, what? I don't understand. What are we talking about here? Anyway.
So you haven't seen Jurassic World Dominion yet, Justin, where we have the Joker of dinosaurs.
Wow. Oh, I haven't seen that great. One yet either.
Yeah.
The dinosaur goes, why so serious?
He's just there because he just enjoys the chaos of it all.
It was crazy when he did the pencil trick on Chris Pratt.
It's true. It's true. But I mean, when he burnt all that money, it really felt like a commentary on dinosaur society.
It was cool. It was really cool.
Yeah.
So I know we're kind of winding down a little bit. Were there any sort of last closing thoughts we wanted to share on the movie?
Well, I'm curious. So earlier, you know, George mentioned that Michael Wincott doesn't totally work for him. And I see where George is coming from on that. I do think that if there's one point of this movie that feels a bit indulgent of by Peele, it is that Michael Wincott character. But I'm curious, Justin, how you feel about him.
I mean, so he's an actor I really like. So I really enjoyed him in this movie, I'll be honest.
I do love The Crow. I should put that out there. He's amazing in that movie.
I think that's where I first saw him.
I think he's doing exactly what Jordan Peele is asking him to do. So it's not, yeah. I don't think George is, not to speak for George, but I don't think you're like criticizing him as a performer. It feels very much like this is what Jordan Peele wants out of this character.
Yeah, and that role just doesn't totally work for me.
I mean, I think the voice is just perfect. I mean, like, I almost wonder if that was a big reason why he cast him. And I just loved, I don't know, I just loved the sort of grizzled, like, this guy who's just, like, seen everything and has to get, like, that perfect, you know, that perfect shot at the end, and actually really justified that moment for me. And it made sense to me because I'm like, oh, it'll be fine because, like, he knows, it's not like he's not trying to survive it. He knows that this thing spits out of inorganic matter, so he'll have it. And, like, I think that's also an interesting commentary. And also, weirdly reflective, the TMZ guy, too, he's all about getting that shot. Like, that's more important to him than his own life. Yeah. So I think it's, you know, I don't know. It did work for me. And I hear what you're saying about the purple people. Yeah, maybe that does go on a little too long. There's something about hearing that song in a totally new context, which works, and maybe a little overdone, but still.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely doesn't like ruin the movie for me or anything. It was just like in a movie full of such great stuff. This was like, all right, I'm ready to move on to the next great thing. I also do think it's funny that, you know, this thing craps out organic matter, and a friend of mine pointed this out to me, and I hadn't considered it, but at the beginning, Otis Sr. is literally killed by shit. Like, it's like a key gets shit out by this thing, and and it falls to the ground and kills him. And that's, you know, kind of a funny joke at the beginning.
Isn't it a nickel?
Uh-huh. You're right. It isn't. It is a.
Yeah.
It is
a but there's coin. A key that lodges in his horse.
That's right. In the horse. Oh, that's right.
She's awful. But also, like, what a great image of, like, you know, like, the we have so, like, denied the, like, the not personhood, but the fact that a horse is a living being, that we treat it like a vehicle so often. And so for there to be an image of a key literally inside the horse, like it is a car, is just, I think, a great visual moment. Like, again, like this sort of like he I feel like other filmmakers will really put a lot of emphasis on that to be like, look at how important this visual is. I think that Peele just kind of puts it there, and if for somebody who wants to look at it, but the movie isn't built around these images, but I think that they really are great images, and I think that they say a lot if you spend the time to think about them.
Yeah, Alex, I think that's a great point, especially the sort of like casual exploitation of horses as vehicles and like pack animals and stuff. You know, at one point I was like on vacation somewhere with some friends, and there was an opportunity to ride horses, and they were like, do you want to get on? And I was like, not really. And they were like, well, we have one. I'm a bigger guy, for those who can't see this. And they were like, well, we have one that can like take your weight. And I'm like, just because it can, like, I don't want to do that to this thing. Like, that sounds awful. I wouldn't want to carry me around. And I just think that the sort of casual employment slavery of these animals is something that is definitely on his mind and should be on more people's minds, maybe.
Yeah, especially as we've learned about more and more productions that have not kept horses safe. And sometimes you
Michael
wonder
Mann's
if the
luck. I mean,
yeah, sometimes you wonder if the end result is really worth it. But yeah.
I mean, if it results in the death of the animal, I don't think it ever is worth it, you know, and unfortunately that does happen far too often.
Yeah. I really like, just for my some of my closing thoughts in this, we've talked a little bit about it, but I really can't stress enough the craftsmanship behind this, like individual sequences, just in terms of what he shows and doesn't show. The setting is so perfect. I love that not only do you get all this cloud cover, but also those hills are so menacing. And they really feel like something is just going to come like from right behind it. Like I almost expected like one of the giants from the Green Knight to like sort of start climbing over one of them.
What so that I would
just,
be.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just wanted to stress that as well, as much as like this is a film that's so full to the brim with ideas, but the craftsmanship and just the like sheer visceral movie making of it, I think, needs to be stressed as well.
Definitely.
And just wide that frame is just incredible. Like it just like you get this full expanse of nature and the sky that looms over this movie so well. And it's just like to see it on a giant screen is just really impactful. And the sound design too.
Oh, the sound design is outrageous.
The sound it makes when it appears, like it's almost like a motor revving up or something. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I also, to your point about the craftsmanship, there are so many little details in this movie that I think really sing. You know, there's a moment where Kiki Palmer is watching Otis Sr. give the same speech that she gives at the beginning. And you can see that she has just memorized what he said, which then explains at the beginning why he's like, oh, you forgot a great in there, because it's now another generation. And so this idea of the legacy and sort of the way that it is pounded into your head and then to make it your own then becomes a difficult thing to do. I think even the little details like that work to sort of reinforce what he's saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess we'll close it up there for now, but let's talk about where we can find everybody. And I'll start with our esteemed guest, George. Where's the best place to find you online?
Yeah, first of all, let me say, wonderful to be back. Had a great time talking about this movie with you guys. As far as where you can find me, LittleHorrorPHL is my username pretty much everywhere, although mostly on Twitter, especially after the new UI update for Instagram, which I hate. So go to Twitter, you'll find me there. Also, the best little horror house in Philly is wherever you podcast. We have so many fun episodes. We have, you know, if you enjoyed this, next week we're recording an episode about Signs. I literally recorded, or I watched Signs before going to this movie without like really knowing what it was about. And so walking out of there, I was like, well, that was fortuitous. And then of course there's all the stuff in Signs about, well, there are no coincidences. So I was like, I was enjoying that. But yeah, so a lot of fun stuff. You can find all kinds of great guests, especially if you're into comedy. We've had a lot of Earwolf guests and stuff like that. A lot of comedians. So yeah, check that out. All kinds of great episodes. We talk about the best horror movie ever made, according to our guest, at least. So it's a lot of fun. Check that out.
Did you have Tasha Robinson on a little while ago?
Yes, we talked about The Ring, and it was wonderful. And I love that movie very much.
Yeah, that was a very surreal moment when I was listening to the Next Picture Show and she mentioned your podcast. Oh, wow. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, like, hey, I know that guy.
She was great. It's a great episode. Katie Reif from the AV Club and stuff, if you know her. We talked about the 1997 movie Cure, which was absolutely unreal. Definitely one of my favorite movies that's been introduced to me through the show. So, not just comedians, lots of great critics and stuff as well. So check it out.
Yeah, and if you want to hear George talk about something other than horror films, you can definitely listen to his episode of It Pod to Be You, the podcast all about romantic films, hosted by a friend of the show, Manish Mathur. He talked about his favorite film from the 60s, Romeo and Juliet, which was a really great listen that I enjoyed.
Thank you very much. Yeah, very. I love Romeo and Juliet. I'm a bit of a bard head, you could say. So it was very fun. And of course, I not only talked about the 60s one, but then also forced Manish to talk about Romeo plus Juliet, the Baz Luhrmann one. So lots of great conversation there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. As for me, you can find my work at thecinemaverick.com. I'm also on Letterboxd at thecinemaverick. I also have a podcast, which I mentioned at the top of the show, Podwork Angels, The Rush Hour. It is dedicated to rock band Rush. We go through each of their studio albums. I do that with Noah France, one of the hosts on this show, and Luke Martin from the Talking Dakota podcast. You can find that on thepopbreak.com. Alex, where can we find you?
So you can follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow this show on at Cinema Joes on Twitter and subscribe to all major podcast platforms. In addition to my work with Cinema Joes, I am the podcast editor for popbreak.com. You could go to thepopbreak.com and click on the podcast tab, see all the shows that I am producing. I host two shows over there. We have a monthly TV podcast called TV Break. This month we're going to be talking about Amazon's Paper Girls, so it'll be interesting to see that. We're also going to be talking about some of the Emmy nominations. Also, I host a MCU rewatch podcast called Bill vs. the MCU, and usually we review three or four of the movies in the MCU at a time. We have done all of phases 1 through 3, and we're about to kick off phase 4 with the Disney Plus TV shows from 2021. But before we do that, we did a breakdown of all of the news that Marvel broke at San Diego Comic-Con, including details on phase 5 and phase 6 and their animated slate. So definitely check out all of that stuff over on thepopbreak.com and clicking on the podcast tab.
Yeah, great. So many things to check out, so little time, as always. But for now, we want to thank all of our listeners and our subscribers. Thank you for sticking with us, and we look forward to having more content for you very soon. So for the Cinema Joes, this is Justin Mancini, signing off.